So my guest today is going to be calling bullshit on brand love. Austin Frank is the founder of WooPunch, a brand design consultancy rooted in the science of how brands grow. Austin is also the man behind brandingbullshit.com, a newsletter that exposes common branding, marketing, and advertising myths. He also co-hosts the BS show with Steph Hammerlink on YouTube. Austin once thought consumers fell in love with brands, preferred brands they identified with, enjoyed engaging with brands online, gravitated towards highly differentiated brands, and remained loyal to their favorite brands for life. He believed as long as you could target your brand's design to an ideal customer persona, your customers would shout your brand from the rooftops, resulting in stratospheric growth. Now he preaches a different reality, one of distracted consumers and brand apathy. He now believes in the power of meaningless brand design, distinctiveness, broad reach advertising, consistency, repetition, and patience to funnel distracted consumers towards brands. So we've got a slightly different format today in that Austin is going to do a 10-minute mini masterclass, and then I'll ask him questions. So without further ado, Austin, all over to you.
Great. So our industry has become flooded with what we're told is a new revolutionary approach to branding. And yet its core idea has been around and consistently debunked for decades. And I'm talking about brand love here, as Shireen alluded to. So brand love is this idea that if you can identify an ideal customer for your brand, then market to them with emotional appeals, you can create a loyal following. And those loyalists will then evangelize your brand to their friends, and your brand will soar as a result. We are told that brand love can be built through loyalty programs, differentiation, customer personas, interactive advertising, hyper-targeting, quality products, and advertising your company's values. Seth Godin tells us that people do not buy goods and services, they buy relations, stories, and magic. Simon Sinek tells us the relationship that someone has with the brand is the same as a relationship that someone has with a person. And Howard Schultz, CEO of Starbucks, tells us that if people believe they share values with a company, they will stay loyal to the brand. But be honest with yourself. Does this ring true to your own experience? Is it true for a handful of brands you buy? Possibly. But what about the other hundreds of brands you buy each month? Do you share the same values with Heinz, or do you buy it because you don't know any other ketchup brands? Do you have a personal relationship with Netflix, or do they simply have a wider selection of movies and TV shows than AMC Plus? Would you ever use the word magic to describe your auto insurance provider? Take even your experience with Apple if you consider yourself an enthusiast. Do you really buy Apple because they identify with your values of thinking differently? Under Tim Cook, Apple hasn't had a single revolutionary product, and yet shares of Apple have soared over 1,000% since he took over from Steve Jobs. No one has ever accused Tim Cook of thinking differently. Simon Sinek may tell us that Apple is wildly successful because of the why behind their company, but he conveniently ignores the fact that Microsoft and Samsung have dominated the computer and phone markets without any discernible why behind their products. Maybe that's why he used Gateway and Dell in his infamous TED Talk. But for a rare few and even fewer buying situations, brand love could exist, but it's certainly not the normal pathway to brand growth. In fact, it's not even the pathway of growth for most brand that gurus like to use as models of brand love. 20% of Apple users don't perceive Apple as any different from competitor brands when asked, despite having completely different operating systems. Harley-Davidson riders buy Honda motorcycles twice as often as they buy Harleys on average. In fact, Harley enthusiasts only make up an estimated 3.5% of Harley's annual revenue. The vast majority of Coca-Cola's annual revenue is generated by consumers who buy a single can of soda or less in a year. These are the inconvenient truths brand love promoters have to wrestle with. The reality is most consumers are distracted when buying. They don't have relationships with brands. They are loyal to a handful of brands they have simply heard of or bought before, not individual brands that they are enthusiastic about. Customers don't want to be part of a tribe with other brand buyers. They don't care about your company's values, and they certainly don't buy magic, whatever the hell that means. Instead of attempting to change the nature of consumer behavior, marketers, advertisers, and brand strategists must accept this reality and act accordingly. Is it nice to have some customers love your brand? Sure. Is it helpful? There seems to be little to no evidence suggesting that it is. To grow your brand, distracted consumers need to know your brand exists and consistently be reminded of its existence. That is 90 to 95% of all marketing. Instead of marketing to a specific ideal customer with emotional appeals, remind every category buyer you exist by executing on five principles that are proven to influence purchase behavior. Number one, be distinctive. So distinctive means two things here. A, if your brand is not sonically and visually distinctive, consumers will confuse you with your competitors. And B, if your distinctive brand, once you've created it, is not prominently displayed throughout your advertising from beginning to end, distracted consumers won't process your brand when they're exposed to your ad. You can't afford to jump on design trends, attempt to infuse deep meaning into your brand assets, and you certainly can't afford to tease your brand out until the end of your ads. Number two, be consistent. Again, consistency means two things here. A, you should advertise frequently and over long periods of time. And B, your advertising should consistently use the same well-established brand assets. You can't afford to invest in short bursts of advertising and then silence. And you can't afford to get bored with your logo or brand character if they're well-established. And number three, reach everyone. First, if your budget allows, you should invest in broad-reaching channels like TV, radio, and out-of-home channels like billboards and digital displays. They are still king. If you are restricted to online advertising, reach as many consumers as possible, as often as possible, as your budget allows. Broad-reaching advertising channels are cheaper in the long run than online channels, and if you can afford to do both, do so. But invest most of your resources into traditional advertising and avoid hyper-targeting online. Second, you must attempt to appeal to all category buyers, not ideal customer personas. Light buyers, those who rarely buy your brand and even from your category as a whole, are your workhorses for brand growth, just like they are for Coca-Cola. Number four, get noticed. Research has demonstrated that efforts at getting consumers to pay conscious attention to advertising are rarely effective. The conventional persuasion model of advertising, rational or emotional, rarely works and can even backfire with overt or cheesy emotional manipulation. Brand purpose appeals, especially if an ad leans one way or another politically or rational messaging. It's better to simply get consumers to look up at your video ads or perk their ears up with radio or podcast ads, then make sure your brand assets are on full display when they do. By getting consumers to notice your advertising and by repeatedly exposing those consumers to your brand assets when they do, your brand will become familiar over time. And that familiarity is the strongest gravitational pull there is for brand choice. We don't buy brands we are not familiar with. And number five, finally, be relevant. Consumers are rarely paying attention to the differences between brands. They are too distracted when buying, and most brands aren't that different from one another anyway. Instead, individual consumers search their memories for a handful of brands that are linked to their specific buying situation when entering a category. These situations are called category entry points, and brands must be linked in consumer memory to these category entry points. So there are two approaches brands could take here using these. Brands could attempt to own a single category entry point, or even a personality trait or some sort of attribute that very few other competitors own. And this is the classic differentiation method. Or brands could link their brands with as many common category entry points as possible. This approach takes much more time and patience, but wins every time in the end. Because research demonstrates that market leaders are linked to more category entry points than smaller brands. They are not linked more strongly with one individual category entry point over others. This evidence flies in the face of differentiation. So to wrap things up, I'd like to take two different super Bowl commercials and compare them. The first took a brand love approach in 2011. Its aim was clearly to engage consumers, get talked about the next day, link positive emotions with the brand, and win creative awards. While this ad isn't as obvious as many ads we see today, in particular ads that exploit trendy social causes to let you know they care, it's clearly of the brand love ilk. The ad features a little boy dressed up as Darth Vader from Star Wars. You probably remember it. He attempts to move various objects with his mind and, of course, fails until he finds himself in front of his dad's car. As a practical joke, the boy's dad presses the remote start feature on his key fob. The car starts. The boy is left amazed. It's cute, hilarious, emotional, and sweet. And as a short film, I absolutely love watching it. Now, while this ad is widely considered to be the best Super Bowl ad of all time, in reality, it fell flat. Why? Most people remember the ad. No one remembers who the ad was for. Even those that might remember within a month of seeing it will have forgotten in 3 years when they finally enter the car market. It was for Volkswagen, by the way. While the ad did get noticed and succeeded in reaching and appealing to all category buyers, it teased its brand assets out until the very end, which were also quite weak at the time. It was inconsistent with all prior VW advertising and centered on a feature, not a category entry point. No one decides to buy a new car just for a remote start. The second ad aired at this year's Super Bowl. It has no shot of winning any creative awards. It has no chance of going viral. It wasn't cute or clever, but its logo is plastered on almost every frame throughout. The ad featured a team of operatives rappelling down from helicopters and popping up out of ponds to install some random guy's new floor mats, mud flaps, bumpers, seat protectors, and a cup holder phone stand for his truck. This ad won't turn heads, but when consumers enter the market for truck accessories, the WeatherTech logo will likely stand out among others without them even knowing why, and they will buy it. I'm going to end finally with a quote from the ad contrarian Bob Hoffman to really put things into perspective. He's really good at that. He said once, "Let me state the obvious. Yes, having a strong brand should be every marketer's primary objective. And yes, the highest goal of advertising is to create a strong brand. But that's it. For the most part, consumers are not in love with brands, despite all the baloney we hear from social media experts. For the most part, consumers do not want to have a conversation with your brand or an authentic relationship with it or engage with it or co-create with it or spend a romantic seaside weekend with it. Of course, brand preferences exist, but brand love is a juvenile fantasy. I swear, if Pepsi were to disappear tomorrow, Pepsi loyalists would switch to Coke with very little psychological damage. Big Mac lovers would cheerfully eat a Whopper without the need for counseling, and Nike loyalists would throw on a pair of Adidas without having to enter rehab."
Great. Well, thank you very much, Austin. Certainly, I agree with much of what you say, but the problem is, how do you apply this to when you're creating a brand for an early stage business? How do you actually, do you want to talk me through what do you do about differentiation if you don't worry about it? How would you deal with a new brand?
Yeah, so when a new brand enters a market, it's most likely going to attract heavy buyers of the category that your brand lives within. So people that are willing to kind of try something new. And so to some extent in the beginning, differentiation can help. The mistake that people make is to lean really heavily into a particular category entry point and kind of, especially one that consumers aren't interested in or thinking about very often. And they end up shooting themselves in the foot later on, because then they have to somehow switch the associations in consumers' minds from something that was very different and radical and unique to something that they can actually relate to in their lives. But the second thing really is, if you are, this particular functionality of, your brand has this particular functionality, you're a challenger brand or whatever the case may be, then you're likely not going to reach light category buyers, because you're likely leaning really heavily into one particular element that you think and want to be different from every other competitor. And when you try to find some little thing, some niche or whatever, that separates yourself from any other competitor, you're likely not going to appeal to what the customer is actually looking for, because usually they're entering the category because they want one of the things that your larger competitors are associated with. So to try to separate that, you can do that in the beginning. It can certainly lead to short-term sales in the beginning. You might attract some of those heavy buyers that are like, this is new, this is different, this is interesting. But eventually you're going to want to invest the money that you make from that back into trying to appeal to really common category entry points.
Right. So you don't have an approach whereby a business starts in a certain way, but might ultimately go a different route, because they don't really have a budget, a lot of businesses, mm-hmm. when they start. So if they're not going to be niche and targeted to a particular customer profile, how are they going to afford all the advertising to just compete with all the businesses out there?
Yeah, and that's a really valid question. And you know, there are some categories where, you know, this might be really hard to hear for some people that are entering those categories, but there are some categories where it's a mistake to enter them, because they do have the big players, they are crowded, and what you can even possibly offer isn't going to be very unique, or isn't going to be very appealing to most consumers, because those bigger brands have the resources and they can simply crush you, right? And that's, you know, that's a really hard thing to hear for a lot of people who are set in this business and they want to go down this particular track. Maybe they want to start an auto insurance company. And without really serious investors, that's going to be very difficult to do when there's already so many auto insurance companies that are really established in the market. Of course, you can do that if you have heavy investment in your brand, and you can potentially just really, especially if you enter a category that doesn't advertise much. There are plenty of categories out there that have major players who aren't advertising very often. But the reality is, for some categories, it's a mistake to enter them to begin with, because you don't have the investment for that. So I would say to smaller brands that are looking to, you know, if someone's starting a business, usually, especially if it's a really small business, often it's just because they want a better life for themselves, mm-hmm. for their families. It's usually not because they want to grow into this great market leader. But if you want to grow into a market leader, eventually you're going to have to really start investing in advertising. And there are some categories that you're going to have to avoid.
Do you actually deal with branding for businesses now, or have you moved on away from actually doing designs for brands?
No, I do. I do. Design.
What sort of businesses are they that you work with?
Yeah. So right now I'm working with, for example, a Catholic birth resource brand. So essentially, she is niching down, but on purpose. She really believes in that there's a void in the Catholic Church of caring for new families, especially those who are pregnant and about to have their first. So she offers birth classes, but also resources for those parents that are very much rooted in Catholic theology. I am a devout Catholic myself. Mm-hmm. So this project really appealed to me. And in her case, she is doing something different, because there wasn't anything like what she was doing. And she really saw a need for that. And so for her, you know, it totally made sense to launch her brand within this category, because there really wasn't much else there.
Right. Well, quite often that's what happens with businesses. I mean, somebody has industry knowledge and they perceive a problem that they want to solve in a certain right. way, which does involve really niching down and going mm-hmm. after a particular target until you get some sort of liftoff, and then you can mm-hmm. advertise more, you know, widely. I quite like Mark Ritson's two-speed approach, where, you know, you do targeted marketing to a particular customer base, but also broad reach marketing mm-hmm. to try and attract all possible segments into right. your sort of business, people who might want to buy down the line, so that they mm-hmm. become aware mm-hmm. aware of you. So what approach would you take to designing a brand then? Yeah. Presumably designers don't really need to understand a business or have a brand strategy if you can just design distinctiveness without worrying about meaning. How do you do that?
Yeah, you know, I think that fundamentally a lot of designers, they love design. And then they watched some Christo videos with the future and they decided, well, you know, maybe I could go beyond design and I could really kind of be a business consultant in addition to design. And so many of those designers aren't equipped to be business consultants, right? They don't have the knowledge or the know-how or even the soft skills to be able to enter into that. I've been able to combine kind of both worlds where when I work with a client, I'm really researching. I'm not just assuming that I'm designing a distinctive brand, but I'm actually doing in-depth research into the market to make sure that I really am. And sometimes with companies with larger budgets, that means measuring distinctive brand assets. But obviously with other clients who don't have those budgets, it really does require an eye for distinctiveness. But another problem that I see often with designers is they get really stuck in the trends, right? They're a particular style of designer maybe, or they just, you know, they're wanting to always design whatever's trendy in the market. And that's a major mistake that most designers make is by designing trends, you're automatically not creating distinctiveness for the brands that you're working for. So there certainly is, not every designer is qualified to dive into business strategy. But those who have a knack for distinctiveness really have a leg up in terms of actual effectiveness for brands. Now, of course you have another side of things where many brands want a trendy design or they want a trendy logo or they want to look like everyone else. I've even had clients who were just like, you know, I want to do this with my social media strategy. I want to follow trends. I want to do that. And it was a really difficult conversation to talk them down from that ledge because they're not going to really reach many people if they are trying to follow trends. And so there's all kinds of issues that designers can come up against. And then other designers who have particular styles and they don't really venture outside of those styles probably won't make great business consultants, but they could still be hired. When I work with clients and we come up with the style, I'm often not doing the actual designs for the business. And so once we've established a style, then I'm going and I'm looking for designers who fit and match that style. Who also are able to do it in a way that's more distinctive. And so that could also be a way that designers who are kind of funneling themselves into a particular style could find work is by working with those clients who are looking for that particular style.
What do you mean by style? I mean, I'm not a designer, so mm-hmm. what can you give me examples of?
Right. There are calligraphy artists. There are designers who do like contour line drawings. There are designers who might work more in like 3D sculpture design. Designers who simply really like a style and they just kind of, without even meaning to go down that particular path, have kind of just found themselves designing in that particular style. I myself have a particular style that I enjoy. And so I actually am always having to stop myself and make sure that what I'm designing for the client isn't something that I would like myself, but is something that would be distinctive in the market.
So you say a knack for distinctiveness. I've noticed a lot of designers don't produce symbols when they create brands, especially for small businesses. You invariably get a stylized wordmark in a particular color, and that's all that the business has by which to try and stand out. And I've often wondered, why don't they actually create symbols? And I wonder, does it take a certain type of designer to be able to create symbols? Because all these well-known brands have symbols, you know, like Nike, Apple, and so on. And they probably were designed right at the beginning before they were big. So,
there's definitely a lot of really generic logo designs out there. If you're going to do a word mark, you should probably, you know, create a custom typeface that's distinctive. I know some brands, there's a trend with some larger brands to just kind of move into like Helvetica typefaces as their logo, and you can do that. You can have a kind of a more generic looking logo. It's not ideal, obviously, but if you surround that logo with other distinctive brand assets, then you can really leverage that brand. So if you have a generic word mark, but then you add a character for the brand, a particular spokesperson that you bring in who's not a celebrity. You don't want a celebrity because they're associated with other things, but someone who has a distinct face that no one knows about, you know, for anything else. Obviously there's audio that you can attach onto things like that. So you can, if you're stuck with a particular logo for whatever reason, you can build around it. But it's probably always going to be ideal to have some sort of symbol, I think, unless you have a really custom typeface that stands out really well.
Well, the other issue that I've experienced with many designers is they want to then change your existing logo to fit a new symbol that you want, rather than creating a symbol to fit around the existing logo that somebody's been using for a few years. So the desire to change things seems to be quite prevalent in the design world. They're not thinking in terms of, how can I preserve what's there and build on it? It's always, how can I throw this away and start again with something really great? And
for one, a lot of designers believe that if they're not rebranding a company that's contracting them to create a brand or to rebrand their brand, they believe if they don't do something radical, like, what's the point of them existing, right? If they don't do something completely new, a lot of the clients are looking for something completely new because they don't understand that they already have existing assets that are working really well in the market. And so that's another place where a designer could dive into business consulting, is if they are able to conduct a comprehensive brand audit where they're looking at all of the different assets, they're measuring those assets among consumers in the market, and they're determining, well, this one you might not like, it might look a little 90s, it might look a little whatever, but it's working really well for people. I think a great example of this, and there could have been, with any rebrand that I like critique, there's all kinds of things I'm completely unaware of that go behind those decisions. Yeah. But one rebrand that stands out to me the most is Pfizer, right? So Pfizer had a very distinctive logo. I mean, it was kind of a generic logo for a medical company, but because Pfizer had been around so long, their logo had become really familiar to most consumers. Yeah. And then right when they're releasing their vaccine, they completely upend their entire logo and redesign it. And that just never made any sense to me at all. But it looks more modern, you know, but no one cares if it looks more modern. The point of a logo isn't to be stylish or trendy or to, it's to work. It has to do its job. And if it doesn't do its job, it's pointless.
Yeah. So you would randomly pick something that appeals to someone if they wanted, say, an animal as a symbol of their brand. You feel it's acceptable to just choose something without any meaning. And then you build meaning into it afterwards, do you?
Yeah, I do. So a great example that I always, this kind of concept of meaningless distinctive design comes from, I'm sure you know, Ginny Romanek of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute. But the best example that I know of a distinctive brand asset, a character in this case, which was completely meaningless to the category, but they kind of attached a meaning onto it with the brand in particular, is the Geico Gecko. I think that is a genius brand design strategy. It's taking a gecko, which has nothing to do with car insurance, but can be tied to the very distinctive name of Geico within the auto insurance industry. And they've been able to really, you know, do a lot of great work with that. It's the gecko essentially always talking about how he keeps getting mistaken for Geico, but then in the process is able to even describe certain category entry points it's very flexible. You can even, because of its, at least in the US, its distinctive British accent, you could play it on the radio and people would recognize it. It's just a really well-rounded, really flexible, really adaptable example of a meaningless brand character that works really well for the brand.
Okay. Well, before we finish, what actually moved you to change your position so radically? Because a lot of designers I know have exactly that approach that you used to have. So what brought the change about?
So, in the beginning, it was not having clients, flooding in. In the beginning of starting my brand consultancy, some people would just get really aggravated by that, and they might just quit their business. I was fortunate enough to be able to have the finances, with my wife working, to really be able to double down on learning. And so a part of it was insecurity. I wanted to make sure that what I was doing for clients was actually working, and I wasn't confident that, even though I was hearing it everywhere, that it was effective, or I just had doubts. And so it started kind of as an insecurity of wanting to make sure that what I was doing was actually effective. And but also the other side of that coin was I stopped looking on YouTube. I stopped reading HubSpot articles. I stopped even reading Harvard Business Review articles for the most part, and went to my local library, got a library card, and just like scanned the shelves within the category of brand design and branding and marketing. And that's when I originally came across Daniel Kahneman's work. He's a Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economic economist, and grabbed his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And that completely was just like, okay, something else is going on here. Nothing that I'm hearing about brand love computes with how we make decisions as human beings. And then eventually I discovered Byron Sharp, and they and the Ehrenberg Bass Institute. And what was beautiful is they completely affirmed one another. And that's really difficult to do. That was a sign for me that there's something going on here. And so that's when I kind of doubled down on that.
I must say, I came at it from intellectual property law because I kept thinking, why are they ignoring this? This is so important, intellectual property issue. And then when I read about Ehrenberg Bass, actually distinctiveness is about distinctiveness in trademark law. So they actually reflected what was going on in the market, that people are not creating distinctive brands, they're creating ads without putting logos on. So it really resonated.
That's interesting.
I just want to ask, what resources then would you recommend? Three resources for somebody who wants to help people create brands.
So from a designer standpoint, the most helpful book for me has been Building Distinctive Brand Assets by Jenny Romanek of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute. I read it after I read How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp, also of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute. Both of those books are really good to work off of one another. And then How Brands Grow 2 is also a really great, How Brands Grow 2 is what kind of expands on when you do, like when you have everything, you have a distinctive brand and it's prominent throughout your advertising, and then you have room to focus on the messaging of your advertising. I think the category entry point chapter in How Brands Grow 2 was really helpful for me to understand that. And then I would also recommend Robert Heath. He's got a book. He's a advertising psychologist, and he's got a book called Seducing the Subconscious. And while I think some of the points that he makes in there conflict with empirical data on how brands grow, and I've been able to kind of pick that apart and figure out why he might believe that. There's the stuff on attention, his work on attention, and how we don't need to actively pay attention to advertising for it to deeply influence us, is really phenomenal. And his work is even been mentioned by Byron Sharp and is respected by Byron Sharp. And so that's also another book that kind of plays off of Daniel Kahneman and marketing effectiveness research really
Great.
well.
We'll add those to the show notes. And my final question to you is, what is the most memorable experience you've had regarding intellectual property as
Oh,
a designer?
interesting. Yeah. That is a good question. Well, my first experience with it, I'll mention that. So I worked for a Catholic nonprofit for 7 years, and we created an online resource called Reach More. And there was a woman who worked for us who was like kind of in a higher level leadership position with I think it was HP way back when. She was retired but kind of just volunteering her time for the organization, and she was all about trademarking the name Reach More, to the point where it became this kind of running joke within the office where, you know, we called her Kathy TM because she was like always on us to make sure to add that little TM at the end of it every time we wrote it anywhere. I think that's the most memorable experience, and it was my introduction to it all and how important it was, and it's expanded from there. Yeah.
Was it ever trademarked? Did she manage to?
It was, yeah, she did. Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, where can people reach you? What's your preferred place?
Yeah, so my newsletter is probably the best place to just stay up to date on what I'm up to. But you can also just email me directly at austin@woopunch.com. So woopunch, woopunch.com is my brand consultancy's website. So you can fill out a form there, even schedule a Calendly meeting with me. But I on principle, I'm not on social media myself. It's a conviction that I had really early on with my business. So you can't reach me there, even though I have old profiles that you could probably find, but it wouldn't be worth reaching out.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much indeed, Austin.
Thank you so much.
Bye.